It happened after the daughter of Afghan envoy to Islamabad was briefly kidnapped and released. The incident, according to police, happened during her back and forth movements on several cabs she herself hired for her travel between Islamabad and nearby city of Rawalpindi. The diplomatic row has preceded extraordinary territorial gains by Taliban, who now claim to have taken over 85% of Afghan territory following the exit of almost all US-led NATO troops from Afghanistan. Kabul has blamed Islamabad to have done little to contain the movements of Afghan Talibans from its nearly 2,700-kilometer-long porous border.
Networks and organizations supporting the Taliban are openly celebrating the destruction of the assets and capabilities of the Afghan people and state. Also, we call on Pakistan to use its influence and leverage for peace and cessation of hostilities.
Islamabad has repeatedly accused President Ashraf Ghani's government and India together to have provided sanctuaries in Afghanistan to anti-Pakistan terrorists who killed tens of thousands of people in this part of the world over the years.
No country has tried harder to get Taliban on the dialogue table than Pakistan. We have made every effort, short of taking military action against Taliban and Pakistan, we have made every effort to get them on the dialogue table and to have a peaceful settlement there. To blame Pakistan for what is going on in Afghanistan, I feel, is extremely unfair. Why would they listen to us when they are sensing victory?
Pakistani officials say that Taliban listen to them, but they do not control them. And over the years, Islamabad has lost significant influence on them. However, Kabul is not willing to accept this argument, given the ongoing military campaign by the Taliban, recapturing districts after districts with little resistance from the security forces in neighboring Afghanistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
In the limelight.
A Florida man was sentenced on Monday, 19th of July, to 8 months in prison for his role in the 6th of January insurrection in Washington, a punishment likely to set a benchmark for later cases. Paul Hodgkins from Tampa, Florida, pleaded guilty to obstructing an official proceeding that he breached the U.S. Senate chamber during the attack on the U.S. Capitol. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Adam Gabbat. The piece is titled, Trump Supporter Sentenced to 8 Months in Prison for Role in Capitol Riot. Florida man was sentenced on Monday, 19th of July, to 8 months in prison for his role in the 6th of January insurrection in Washington, a punishment likely to set a benchmark for later cases. Paul Hodgkins from Tampa, Florida, pleaded guilty to obstructing an official proceeding after he breached the U.S. Senate chamber during the attack on the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January. Paul Hodgkins was filmed wearing a Trump 2020 t-shirt with a flag over his shoulder and eye goggles around his neck, and seen taking a selfie with a self-described shaman in a horned helmet and other rioters and the days behind him. He is the first rioter to be sentenced for a felony crime in connection with the attack, which saw hundreds of Trump supporters storm the Capitol building after they were fed lies about election fraud, causing Donald Trump's defeat by Joe Biden. More than 570 people have been charged with taking part in the riot, during and after which 5 people died. Prosecutors had asked for Paul Hodgkins to serve 18 months, saying in a court filing he, like each rioter, contributed to the collective threat to democracy by forcing lawmakers to temporarily abandon their certification of Joe Biden's election victory and to scramble for shelter. Speaking in court in Washington, D.C. on Monday, 19th of July, Paul Hodgkins apologized and said he was ashamed of his behavior. Reading from a prepared text, he described being caught up in euphoria as he walked through Washington, then followed a crowd of hundreds up to Capitol Hill and into the Capitol building itself. If I had any idea that the protest would escalate the way it did, I would never have ventured further than the sidewalk of Pennsylvania Avenue, Hodgkins told the U.S. District Judge Randolph Moss. He added, "This was a foolish decision on my part." District Judge Randolph Moss said Hodgkins had actively and intentionally participated in an attack that threatened democracy itself, BuzzFeed reported. District Judge Randolph Moss also said Americans needed to be aware that assaulting the Capitol will have severe consequences. "The court here had to consider both what I think are extremely damaging events that occurred that day, but also who Mr. Hodgkins is as an individual," Judge Moss said. "And as I think is reflected by the sentencing I imposed, I tried to strike a balance." Hodgkins' sentence could influence other defendants as they decide whether to accept plea deals or go to trial. He and others are accused of serious crimes, but were not indicted, as others were, for roles in larger conspiracies. Lawyer for Paul Hodgkins had asked District Judge Randolph Moss not to impose a prison sentence, saying the shame that would attach to Hodgkins for the rest of his life should be factored in. "Whatever punishment the court may provide will pale in comparison to the scarlet letter Mr. Hodgkins will wear for the rest of his life," Patrick N. LeDuc wrote in a court filing, citing a Nathaniel Hawthorne novel in which a woman accused of adultery is forced to wear the letter A. The filing argued that Hodgkins' conduct was not markedly different from those of Anna Morgan Lloyd, other than stepping onto the Senate floor. Anna Morgan Lloyd, a 49-year-old from Indiana, was the first of roughly 500 arrested to be sentenced. She pleaded guilty to misdemeanor, disorderly conduct, and last month was sentenced to 3 years probation. Hodgkins was not accused of assaulting anyone or damaging property. Prosecutors said he deserved some leniency for taking responsibility almost immediately and pleading guilty to obstruction, which carries a maximum 20-year prison sentence. But they also noted how he boarded a bus in his hometown of Tampa, Florida, bound for a Donald Trump rally, carrying rope, protective goggles, and latex gloves in a backpack, saying that showed he came to Washington prepared for violence. On 6th of January, he walked through grounds littered with smashed police barriers and broken windows, passing police officers and others injured as a crowd surged towards the Capitol building, prosecutors said. "Time and time again, rather than turn around and retreat, Paul Hodgkins pressed forward," the government said. Some reacted with incredulity and outrage at what they saw as a lenient sentence and in some cases bias, especially compared with situations such as in Texas, where a black woman from Fort Worth, Crystal Mason, was sentenced to 5 years in prison after being convicted of illegally voting, even though she didn't know she was ineligible to vote when she went to the polls in 2016. And another case of a Texan, Hervis Rogers, who now faces the possibility of a stiff sentence after being declared ineligible to vote because he was on parole and had waited in line for 7 hours.
ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today we're going to be examining the necessity of prophethood and why is it necessary for God to send the divine revelation to human beings. We said that one of the reasons why this is necessary is that in order for human beings to achieve felicity in this world and in the hereafter, for them to be fulfilled and be happy, is for them to have a knowledge of God, a knowledge of themselves, a knowledge of their purpose in this world. And this is not something that a human being can arrive at simply by using his own faculties, his own powers of reasoning. It's true that reason and the intellect arrives at certain universal conclusions, right, regarding God and the hereafter, however, and about man. However, these universal conclusions are not enough for the felicity of man. Rather, it's also necessary for man to have a knowledge of the particulars and the details of these matters. And because the faculty of reason, if it's not assisted by means of something else, some other faculty which has an ability to understand particular details, it cannot arrive at those details. Therefore, and there is no faculty within man which has the ability to understand these spiritual, the details of these spiritual and these non-materialistic affairs and problems. Therefore, there's a need and there's a need for the assistance of divine revelation. It's possible for somebody to raise the following question here and say that, who said man doesn't have a faculty by means of which he can understand the affairs, the particulars and the details of the affairs about these matters that we've been speaking about? We are of the opinion that a human being is an immaterial being, and we has a connection with the immaterial realm, and if he follow and he has the ability to connect to that world and to understand and actually see these affairs for himself. For example, there was a young person in the time of the Prophet. The Prophet entered the mosque and he saw this person was disturbed. He asked this person. This person said, "It's as if I see the fires of hell. It's as if I see and I hear the lamenting and the screams of the people who are burning in hell." So he had an awareness and a knowledge of these affairs of the hereafter. Right? So who said human beings do not have such a faculty within them to understand the details of these affairs? No, they do have this faculty, and so there's no need for revelation. We can use this mystic knowledge that a human being has to acquire knowledge of these affairs. The answer to this question is very clear, and that's this: that it's true that human beings have this faculty within themselves, and they can acquire this knowledge, this particular and detailed knowledge about these particular spiritual matters. But this is only when a person travels and acts upon the path of the obedience of God. And this is a path that is only delineated by God himself. A man cannot understand how God wants to be obeyed. It's only something that God can determine for him. So again, there's a need for prophecy. Prophecy comes, revelation comes, and tells us how we are to obey God, how we are to travel the various stages of the obedience and servitude to God till we arrive at his proximity, and we're given that special knowledge. So again, without revelation, we can't have that knowledge. Thank you for joining us here today. We were examining the necessity of prophethood and revelation. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
if you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
President, a sacrificial lamb, or chief executive running the country? Media and experts opposed to the Islamic Republic of Iran tend to display the presidency as a formality and the president as a facade to an actually totalitarian system of governance. But is the president actually a disposable entity, an individual to be blacklisted and sacrificed once his presidential term comes to an end? A scapegoat to have all the country's woes blamed on. Our experts today explain why some may believe so or claim to believe so, when in fact presidents are kept quite close to leadership even after their terms run out. Do stay with us to hear out the experts. First impressions leave a mark. Iran's first president, Abolhassan Banisadr, economist and politician, was appointed in 1980 and dismissed and wanted for treason in 1981. But he had touched a sensitive nerve finally, which was wanting to negotiate with a terror group that later attacked Iran alongside Ba'athist Iraq. That would be the MKO. He was not a typical case, however. Mr. Abdullah Abdullahi is a media man with a comprehensive view of current affairs in context and against background. He shares his views freely to match the question. He received us at Tasnim News Agency, where he writes.
One of the distinguishing features of the Iranian political system is that it has been able to control power well. That is, the Islamic Republic has proven that it can confront the intoxicating feeling of being in power and restrain the politicians in that sense. This management of power is an important term in political systems. When a political system is being established, one of the most complicated questions and challenges is how to restrain that power. That is to be given to a person or an institution so that they perform within specific bounds and transfer the power when necessary.
Mr. Mehdi Nourai came to Press TV Studios from the Constitutional Council's Research Center to share with us his exacting knowledge of the law with regard to the president and leader's authorities and how they've manifested in practice. Why do foreign media tend to paint a pale, ineffective picture of Iran's presidency?
Basically, because they don't want the Islamic Republic to develop and make progress, the foreigners try to target the pillars of power in Iran, cast doubt about it by encouraging speculation about elections, about their reliance on people's votes, about self-confidence, independence, confidence in countries' internal capabilities, and the use of Iran's scientific capacities. Issues, including our nuclear program, which has been the culmination of scientific and technical advancements made by the young people in our country, are being targeted by foreigners.
Then again, the highest authority in the country not being the president might give the impression his hands are tied beside a leader and commander of all armed forces and powers, except the leader is not known to exert his influence irrationally in foreign affairs, a sensitive matter to him actually as someone who has expressed categorical mistrust for the U.S. That would be Ayatollah Khamenei.
مهمترین و مؤثرترین مدیریت کشور ریاست جمهوری است. اینی که حالا بعضیا میگن رئیس جمهور اختیار چند ساله که از این حرفا گاهی کنار گوشه زده میشه. رئیس جمهور اختیاراتی نداره، رئیس جمهور تدارکات چیست، رئیس جمهور 12% 15% چجوری هم محاسبه میکنن من نمیدونم. اختیارات داره. اینا همش خلاف واقعه. یا از روی بیمسئولیتی گفته میشه یا از روی بی اطلاعی گفته میشه یا خدای نکرده غرض‌ورزی در کار هست. اینجوری نیست. رئیس جمهور یکی از پرمشغله ترین و پرمسئولیت ترین دستگاه هاست، یعنی یکی از نمیشه گفت از همه مدیریت های کشور رئیس جمهور پرمشغله تر و پر مسئولیت تر این هاست.
رهبری به تعبیری میشه گفت بیشتر نقش
The leader is in a sense a policymaker and an observer at the highest level of how the goals of the system are being achieved. As described by the preamble of Constitution, the leader's role is to keep the system on its original Islamic path. There might be an administration whose policies aren't in line with that of the leader, meaning that the leader would adopt different positions if he were to take the helm. But because people cast their ballots for that administration and preferred its stance, the leader allows the cabinet to follow its goals so far as they agree with the Constitution.
بر اساس قانون آنچه را که مورد توجهش بوده دنبال میکنه. ببین دولت هاشمی دولت به خصوص
Look, Hashemi's government was a specific one with its particular orientations, behaviors and management type. Mr. Khatami's cabinet was a polar opposite to its predecessor. People felt Mr. Khatami's government was the exact opposite of that of Mr. Hashemi and voted for him. The same goes for Mr. Ahmadinejad's government. Mr. Rouhani's administration also opposed Mr. Ahmadinejad's policies. If it were true that the presidents take ceremonial positions, we would and witness such disparity in opinions and performances among the governments during all these years.
For a better understanding of roles of power and their extension, let's put faces to them by introducing presidents that have come and gone since Iran's millennia-old monarchy fell with the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Presidents' backgrounds, that is, and what became of them after their governance. Governing institutions will also be touched upon in today's episode. I'll begin with the leader, however, who was himself president when the Assembly of Experts selected him to replace Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, first leader of the Islamic Republic, upon his demise 10 years since the revolution. Now 81, the then young cleric Sayyid Ali Khamenei in the early 1960s joined the religious opposition movement of Ayatollah Khomeini against the king or Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. In 1979, when the revolution happened, he served on the Revolutionary Council, which ruled alongside the interim government. He subsequently became Deputy Defense Minister and helped organize the IRGC, Islamic Revolution Guard Corps. Sayyid Ali Khamenei did not become president right after Abul Hasan Bani Sadr. The second president was Mohammad Ali Rajai, who was short-lived in years and professionally. It was after his assassination that Sayyid Ali Khamenei ascended to the presidency, a presidency that continued by promotion to leadership, the highest position in the country. Already an ardent advocate of the concept of velayat-e-faqih, that's governance by the religious jurist, Sayyid Ali Khamenei was among the founding members of the IRP, that's the Loyalist Islamic Republican Party. In 1981, when the IRP's upper ranks were shattered by a series of bombings that killed the party's Secretary General and President Rajai, Ayatollah Khamenei had himself gotten paralyzed in the right arm, but was promoted to IRP Secretary General. And within weeks, he became the IRP's candidate for the presidency and was elected to succeed Rajai. At the time, the presidency was largely ceremonial and with the greater power vested in the Prime Minister, Mir Hossein Mousavi at the time. Our guest explains why the presidency in Iran is more complex and challenging than other countries at large.
The first thing to take into account is how the political system looks, what the mechanisms are, what form the institutions take, and how it formulates the political order. They aren't to be taken as gospel. For instance, there might be a presidency or a chancellorship, such as what we see in Germany. There are countries, including the UK, that have a prime minister. The US, France, and Germany all have their way of running the country. There are disparate forms of political systems among the countries that claim to be democratic. The fact that they differ in their form doesn't mean they're necessarily anti-democratic or have imposed specific constraints on democracy.
From what you say, the leader minimally interferes in the president's affairs. So why is Iran painted as a totalitarian system?
Speaking of totalitarian regimes, one of their key characteristics is that they don't observe the rule of law, or that they're oppressive toward their people and depend on foreigners. These are characteristics that have been mentioned in constitutional books. They don't depend on the people. This is why the Islamic Republic of Iran has held nearly 44 elections over the 42 years that have elapsed since the victory of the Islamic Revolution. And that's not counting midterm elections. If we include them too, the figure will rise over 200 elections. The lowest turnout in Iran's election has been the highest figure in other countries' elections. If we consider this, we'll see that the Islamic Republic has always stressed the importance of people's role. Article 177 of the Constitution has made this principle basically irrevocable. That's why the characteristics of the Islamic Republic can never be compared to these totalitarian regimes that don't observe the rule of law.
Now, as leader, what differences might have occurred with presidents that have succeeded him and served under his leadership? Mohammad Khatami, a reformist, was president from 1997 to 2005. He pushed for détente with the West and more social and political freedom in Iran. After two terms, the maximum length in office, he was succeeded by conservative Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Khatami was with Ahmadinejad's rival, former and last prime minister, Mir Hossein Mousavi at the time. That's during the events of 2009, which led to Mousavi's house arrest. Ms. Zohra Elahian is an MP and on the Parliamentary Committee for National Security and Foreign Policy. So we made the trek down to Parliament to hear her views on all matters presidential.
Unfortunately, two of the presidential candidates in 2009 voiced their objections outside the legal norm, which led to chaos and crisis in the country and endangered the national security and the interests of the people. The main problem was that the two candidates didn't respect the country's legal structure. They didn't pursue their objection to the election result through its legal course and try to draw people on the streets, even though the leader of the Islamic Revolution said the complaints and electoral process can be legally reviewed. But unfortunately, these candidates didn't choose the legal path and issued provocative statements to bring people on the streets.
Yet Khatami was invited to join the Expediency Council as a member, but he declined the offer. He never gave up political activity, however. His activity was extensive since 1988. He has in fact been considered the reason for Mr. Rouhani's victory in the presidential elections of 2013 and 2017. To fall back into sequencing, Mohammad Khatami was succeeded by a conservative Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Tehran mayor. He was seen by some as a protege of Ayatollah Khamenei, but he faced mounting criticism over his government's management of the economy and foreign policy decisions. And finally, he fell out with the leader after reportedly trying to increase his own powers to ends not favorable to the leadership. He still remained in office. His two terms ended 8 years ago, but to this day he remains in the Expediency Council, a high body advising the leader. I asked, why would you say some Iranian presidents change course after their term or when it's coming to a close?
Unfortunately, it's possible for some presidents who have the experience of being in office for 4 or 8 years to not obtain a clear understanding of the country's legal and political system, or they might receive wrong advice, so they might depart from the legal path. We saw the example in 2009 when this lack of proper understanding of the political and legal system and ignoring the national interest and security created crises and challenges in the country, which cost the people some damage. It basically goes back to the president and the advice he receives.
Why have some of our presidents taken a different route once they finished with their presidency or towards the end of their terms?
به هر حال اون دو سال پایانی وقتی که دولت‌ها بر سر کار هستن.
Anyhow, in the last 2 years of a government's terms, such issues might occur because of several reasons. One is that they're coming closer to their end of the term in office and see themselves less reliant on the people's support. They even find themselves less in need of support from the political system. At the same time, they want to stay at the highest possible level of power after leaving office.
Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was succeeded in 2013 by now outgoing President Hassan Rouhani, who after two terms in office, like most before him, will be handing down his responsibilities to President-elect Ebrahim Raisi in early August. Now, Rouhani's office has been interesting, both lauded and lamented at the same time. It's interesting to see where he will land. But during office, he negotiated the landmark nuclear deal, the JCPOA, with world powers. Although warned against trusting the U.S. by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader still gave him his blessing and go ahead with the deal.
در نظر داشته باشیم که اختیاراتی که قانون اساسی به رئیس جمهور داده.
Keep in mind that the powers conferred on the president by the Constitution are specified in Article 113, which specifies executive powers of the leader, which is very brief, and as stated by Article 110, all other powers go to the president. In line with this, making decisions about the country's revenue, based on Article 52 of the Constitution, is with the government, which is headed by the president. It's the president who determines how the revenue is spent. That's specified in the budget bill, which is presented by the government, headed by the president.
Now, talking of sequencing, an important link was left out. That would be President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, who, like the early building blocks of the revolution, is associated with the IRP and Revolutionary Council. He was the two-term president before President Khatami and after the once president Khamenei. I left him out as his office in those earlier days of the revolution is not associated with the matter of how much the leader may have exerted influence on his decision-making. Mind you, he did look to reducing Iran's international isolation by reviewing ties with Europe. This would be part of a greater strategy to use foreign investment and free enterprise to boost the country's war-torn economy. We are talking the eight-year Iraq-Iran War of the 1980s. And domestically, he implemented family planning policies to reverse policies that would lead to population growth. This was against the background of a very principalist establishment and leadership. Not to forget, Rafsanjani was instrumental in preparing the conditions for President Khamenei to succeed the then leader Ayatollah Khomeini. Rafsanjani, despite all the differences of opinion in the fields of foreign policy and production and industry with some principalists and reformists, remained in high positions, such as chairman of the Expediency Council and chairman of the Assembly of Leadership Experts.
Marhum Rafsanjani
The late Rafsanjani has long been one of the key figures in the Islamic Revolution and an important figure in the political arena in the country. But at some point, unfortunately, some of the positions and actions were somewhat at odds with the views of the leader of the Islamic Republic. However, the leader always wanted to avoid rifts from being created between the officials, especially between himself and Mr. Hashemi Rafsanjani, and always tried to manage the situation to prevent that rift from taking shape.
I've pointed more or less to the backgrounds of the President and Prime Minister Mousavi. To put in a little more where I've left it thin, Mir Hossein Mousavi, architect, painter, intellectual and politician, served as Iran's Prime Minister from 1981 to 1989, and afterwards as presidential advisor from 1989 to 2005. That's advisor to two prominent presidents, Rafsanjani and Khatami. He was a member of various councils and assemblies for many years after being the prime minister, and his consultations were put to use. Even after the events of 2009, the system did not try him, but put him under siege. Mousavi's marvel during premiership was that he managed to control the inflation and ensure the reliable availability of essential items during the long-drawn imposed war with Iraq. He served as a member on the Expediency Council and Council of Guardians, now known as the Constitutional Council. Khatami, during the 1960s and 70s, gained a reputation as an opponent of the rule of the Shah. After the 1979 Islamic Revolution, he was elected to the Majlis or Parliament and later became Minister of Culture twice. In 1997, he won a landslide presidential victory with almost 70% of the vote by an electorate looking for more socio-political freedom and an open economy inviting foreign investment.
The presidency in Iran is somehow more sensitive in that. A significant number of powerful governments in the world are trying to create hurdles for this key post in the Islamic Republic of Iran. In this way, the presidency is more serious, special and unique compared to the same post or its equivalent chancellorship or premiership in other countries. But in terms of its internal reality, it's like any other political system. The president has the highest executive powers in the country and is carrying out his duties.
I mentioned high councils former presidents have found themselves in to continually put in practice their experiences gained during presidency. To clarify, the Expediency Council is an advisory body for the leader with an ultimate adjudicating power in disputes over legislation between the Parliament and the Guardian Council or Constitutional Council. The leader appoints its members from among prominent religious, social, and political figures. In October 2005, he gave the Expediency Council supervisory powers over all branches of government. The Assembly of Experts for the Leadership is an 88-member body of Islamic jurists, elected once every 8 years by direct popular vote. Their mandate by constitution is to appoint, monitor, and possibly dismiss the leader. Candidacy for this council depends on approval by the Constitutional Council, a 12-member body appointed by the leader and parliament, as well as being an Islamic jurist.
Usually, the Expediency Council enlists the help of the previous presidents. This council can bring different branches of the government together and resolve the differences between the president and the parliament and offer advice to the leader about the general policies of the system. This is an important position where previous presidents play a role, but some presidents have been left outside due to their weak performance. It's only natural for a president who's been in office for many years but doesn't have a clear understanding of the political and legal structure and whose performance has harmed the public and national security to be left aside. It's better that he is limited so he can't do further damage to the national interests and the security.
Since so many of the said positions are filled by election, allow me to say where national elections are held. They're held to decide on a president, members of parliament, assembly of experts members, and city and village councillors. Parliament or Majlis has 290 members currently, elected for a four-year term in multi- and single-seat constituencies. Ms. Elahian believes the importance of elections is undisputed, unquestionable.
The fact that different media are focusing their attention on Iran's president proves that it's a very important political and executive position in the country and is far from ceremonial. That's why the media are focusing on this issue, which is also being talked about on an international scale. The other point is that the presidents have to be responsible for their performance both during their term and after they leave office. This is because the management of the significant portion of the country, its structure and budget, is given to the president and his team, and he enjoys the powers that people grant him by their votes. The president and his ministers have to be responsible for the power given to them during the 4 or 8 years in office.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after for a dip into any manner of matters Iranian or a visit to any personality or walk of life. Bye for now.
The Light.
There is a famous quote: one should always try to turn every disaster into an opportunity. A Swiss hiker with Parkinson's disease has put that saying into practice by hiking more than 1,100 kilometers across the Alps. Yves Aubusson, suffering from the disease for more than 16 years, completed the challenge in less than 100 days last year. During his journey, he scaled high-altitude peaks and crossed nearly 100 mountain passes. Aubusson says his first goal was to inspire fellow patients to be active even if they are gravely affected by the incurable disease. But, he says, his major motivation was to raise awareness of the debilitating neurological illness, which is little known.
What motivated me to do this hike is that I wanted people to know better this disease that is so little known. So I did something that I think was important and that maybe people will relate to. The fact that I did this hike, some people understood it more than I hoped. It went beyond our hopes.
The 52-year-old hiker, previously a professional golfer, is now planning for a new challenge that includes a bike and a tricycle. But he believes that if he could encourage other patients to do sports, he will definitely win his challenge. Burpees are one of the gym exercises that many consider it either a funny workout or simply avoid to do. But that's not the case with a Brazilian man who set a new Guinness World Record with 951 burpees in just 1 hour. Cassiano Rodriguez Liriano, a professional mixed martial arts fighter, completed this feat nearly a month ago that was later verified by Guinness record adjudicators. Liriano says he was driven by a promise made to his niece, Rebecca, who was born with a severe heart disease, and the gym set up a fundraising effort for her. Liriano had originally aimed for 1,000 burpees, but fallen short of that mark due to a leg injury he sustained 2 days before the feat.
I'm tired. It didn't go as smoothly as I thought it would go. I'm in so much pain now on my leg because I got hurt. But I'm very, very happy with the accomplishment and in being able to help my niece. So that's the most important thing.
Loriano has not met his family since moving to Singapore in May 2019. He says the only way he could help them is using his athleticism. The previous world record was held by a Canadian who performed 879 chest-to-ground burpees within the same time limit in March this year. In the US, creative designers are trying to raise awareness about the environmental issues in a fun and playful way. A climate change-themed mini golf course has recently opened to public in New York City. It consists of 18 holes, each one featuring an environmental problem or a potential solution like habitat loss, energy inefficiency, and emissions. Designed by local artists, the course is made with recycled materials.
Climate change and the environment are such important topics right now and important issues that faces all of us now and will face us in future generations. So by bringing the environmental issues to the forefront in a fun, playful way like mini golf, it really sparks the conversation and helps folks understand the scope of the issue.
Visitors have welcomed the idea, saying it's both entertaining and educational. Organizers say all of the money made from the golf course will go to two local environmental groups. Let's go to Ukraine to meet the world's oldest tennis player, who has been playing the sport for over half a century. Leonid Stanislavski, now 97 years old, has competed in various world championships. When he was a 30-year-old gymnast, he started training tennis three times a week. The Guinness World Record holder is now practicing for the 2021 Super Seniors World Championship, which will be held in Mallorca, Spain. Stanislavski believes that people can play tennis at any age.
It's an elegant type of sport. It's good physical exercise. It is a beautiful game, and there is one more thing about tennis. You can play tennis no matter what age you are.
The world's oldest tennis player revealed his secret to a long life, a combination of good genes and regular sport. His goal is to live to 100 years old and take on prominent tennis player Roger Federer. The old athlete also wishes to make a parachute jump. The largest museum in the world dedicated to the study of space has made its debut in Shanghai, China. Inspired by the orbits of celestial bodies, the layout of the building has no straight lines or right angles. The museum, designed by New York-based Anid Architects, is intended to create an immersive experience for visitors to engage in a real astronomical phenomenon. For instance, visitors can take a trip into a starry night in the optical planetarium theater.
What we aim to create is a real environment for people to look up to the starry sky. To achieve this goal, we've installed a high-precision planetarium projector at the center of the theater, which can project the sharp spots of stars on the screen with countless optical fibers. The demonstration effects are very vivid.
After moving through the museum's galleries and curved hallways, the final area visitors pass through is the sky space of the inverted dome. The viewing area of the inverted dome is about reducing almost all separation between people and the stars. The opening follows a five-year construction process in the city's Lingang district.
French artist has created a huge cardboard installation in the shape of a hanging bridge. The artwork is 18 meters in length and hovers above Rome's Tiber River with the help of three gigantic helium-filled balloons. Olivier, who created the work, was inspired by famous Italian Renaissance architect and sculptor Michelangelo. The Italian master had been tasked with the constructing a bridge on Tiber to connect the gardens of the Villa Farnesina to the Farnese Palace. However, he died before he could complete the venture. Now Michelangelo's mission has been accomplished, centuries after his demise by one of his admirers.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Every year, a lot of animals lose their life due to various kinds of accidents, but some of them are lucky enough to get a second chance. Perseus, the Greek cat, is one of them. The stray feline was taken to a vet in the city of Larissa last year after a terrible accident. The vets had to perform 3 surgeries, but Perseus lost the same number of limbs. However, he managed to stay alive and was given prosthetic legs. Perseus has adapted perfectly to his new limbs and now uses them to get around. He has also managed to snatch the heart of his saviors as visitors at the clinic where he cured have grown. The Japanese art collective has created a mesmerizing environment in a forest where nature and technology come together. In the mountains of Kyushu in southern Japan, the nature comes to life after the dark. Flowers and trees are illuminated in a glowing ripple shine, while rocks turn colorful with light installations. A waterfall made of light pours gently on a bright rock. Some rocks have calligraphy, and artificial pond projects colorful fish too. The artists behind the work say their aim is to unite technology and nature.
The thing is, sometimes people think it's a digital and nature is completely it's against each other. But in the same time, we think it's in a digital and the nature is it's quite easy to it's merged.
The Japanese team also wants to raise awareness about the original beauty of the nature, which they say is often ignored. To remind people of that, they hold exhibitions combining projections, sound, and carefully designed spaces. So far, the group has organized several art shows of this kind. Animals have been providing protection and service to people since time immemorial. They have not only been the source of food like meat, butter and milk, but also served humans by eating plants toxic to them. Authorities in New York City have taken 2 dozen goats from a nearby farm to the Riverside Park in Manhattan to munch on invasive weeds. They say it's an environmentally friendly win-win for the species removal at the park. The goats get to feast on overgrown bush, and Riverside Park Conservancy doesn't have to dump harsh chemicals on weeds. Park officials say it's both healthy for the goats and good for the environment.
As part of our woodland restoration initiative, 2 years ago, we unleashed a very hungry group of goats into a stretch of the park that had been overrun with invasive plants. And wow, did they exceed expectations. We called it Gotham because we put the goat in Gotham. They chowed down on Japanese knotweed. They noshed on porcelain berry. They snacked on multiflora rose. They easily traversed the hard-to-reach terrain behind me and gulped down poison ivy without even giving it a second thought. Since goats are naturally effective weed whackers, putting them to work in Gotham is like treating them to an all-you-can-eat buffet. It's healthy for the goats, and it's good for the environment. That's farm to table.
People visiting the goats at the zoo say these animals are emotionally intelligent and connect with people. Goats are an ingenious approach to weed removal, eating species dangerous to humans like poison ivy. Of the 24 goats, 5 will call Riverside Park its home through the end of August. For some others, the public can vote to determine which goat will be crowned the greatest of all time. The winner will be announced by the end of the summer.
Singapore unveils one of the world's biggest floating solar panel farms in a bid for quadrupling its solar energy production by 2025. The farm is as big as 45 football fields. It includes 122,000 solar panels. The panels are designed to last for 25 years, and drones will be used to assist with maintenance. The farm is located on a reservoir in western Singapore and will generate enough electricity to power its 5 water treatment plants. It puts Singapore among the few countries in the world with a water treatment system fully powered by green energy. The farm can reduce Singapore's carbon emissions by 32,000 tons annually. Floating solar panels perform up to 15% better than conventional rooftop panels. That's because of the cooling effect of water, and that shading from other buildings does not affect them. Singapore is currently developing 4 other floating solar panel projects. Baby kittens are considered the cutest baby animals by many of us, but just wait to see this baby hippo, which was born during a full moon. The male calf was born in a Mexican zoo last month. He weighs 30 kilos upon birth. Since then, he has spent most of his time bonding with his mother. The vets in the zoo say he is healthy, playful, strong, and a bit hyperactive. They say some of his habits are surprisingly similar to that of a horse or a dolphin. Generally, reproduction among zoo hippos is not a common practice. Therefore, newborn calves are signs of high quality of the lives and habitats of their parents. A zoo in central France is welcoming the birth of a male giraffe after 15 months of waiting. The calf is named after Melman, the giraffe character in the Madagascar movie franchise. He was born on Sunday in a Beauval Zoo park. He is 170 centimeters tall and weighs 55 kilograms. Zookeepers say Melman is a special baby.
A giraffe birth here. It's our second birth since we've had the group of females established for a few years. So for us, it's still quite an important and exceptional event because it's not every day that we have a giraffe birth.
The giraffe keepers say Melman stood on his feet for the first time 45 minutes after being born. Since zoos have opened in France, visitors can enjoy seeing little Melman playing around with his mother. The birth of the baby giraffe is good news for wildlife preservation, as according to estimates, the number of the animal in the wild has dropped by about 30% since the 1980s.
Malaysians at a vaccination center in the city of Kuching have witnessed a surprising scene. A T-Rex turned up to get his COVID-19 jab. Fitness instructor Kenny Sia dressed up in a dinosaur costume to amuse people, doesn't he look fabulous, and protect himself. Sia said he made the decision to lift up the spirits of frontline health workers, is exhausted by vaccinating over 5,000 people a day. People rushed to take pictures with him, hailing his appearance and historic and funny.
IRIB English Radio.